Blog Talk Radio.
This is not a drill. This is not a drill. General quarters. General quarters. All hands on your battle stations.
Welcome to Midrats with Sal from Commander Salamander and Eagle One from Eagle Speak at Sea or Shore, your home for a discussion of national security issues and all things maritime. Good afternoon, everybody, and thank you for joining us here on this Thanksgiving Day weekend for our best of. This is actually a best of a best of. We're going to do a repeat of our best of show that we did back on Memorial Day weekend in May. We're going to start off with Norman Friedman, and for those that listened to us last week with YN2 and his return from Afghanistan, this would have been his mid-deployment or early deployment visit for us. Hope you enjoy it, and we'll see you again live next week. The line, Norman Friedman, if you read anything involving ships, strategy, the direction of our Navy and where we need to be going, you should know Norman Friedman. Welcome to Midrats, Norman.
Thank you very much. Glad to be here.
And thanks for coming and filling the gap. And what we'll do is I think you've been listening to this. Let's just go ahead and pivot here. Because one thing that Galler and I really enjoyed in our discussions with you in San Diego last month, and also a lot of the material that you've written and the panels you've been on, is subject of what kind of Navy we need to have. What type of Navy do we need to be focused on in order to move forward here beyond 2010 as the rest of the world revolves around us? So if you could, just to get things kicked off, Norman, tell us where you see we are here in 2010 and where you see there's a gap in the Navy that we're trying to develop that we need to perhaps focus a little more attention and a little more intellectual rigor to.
Well, let's go back to what I heard of the last few speakers. The Navy publishes a strategy talking about how it has to work with many other navies. And, in fact, if you have sort of dispersed global problem, any very expensive Navy will find it hard to be in many places at once. And then the question is, do you turn into a Navy of less expensive ships in very large numbers if you could possibly manage that, which is a question, or is there some way in which you can encourage other governments who benefit from the sea and who have somewhat similar requirements to somehow get together with us? That's a very hard thing to do. I've been working on British naval history, which turns out to be very much like ours, and their problem always was that the Commonwealth governments clearly had the same interest in protecting the sea as the British government. However, the question then was, how did you make them contribute? Or rather, how did you convince them to contribute? Because, like us, the British didn't control those places, even though we may imagine they did. The people running places like Australia and Canada could decide whether or not to pay up. So how do you convince them that it's worth the trouble? Or how do you convince them that they ought to pay more than the absolute minimum when you're willing to pay a great deal because it's in your interest? And we've been talking a lot about building larger numbers of smaller ships, which are these little combat ships. The question really to me is what we contribute to the pot that the other countries can't contribute, in return for which we can convince them to contribute more of their local forces. Okay? Hello?
Yep.
So
what you're looking at is kind of that, I can't stand the phrase, but kind of leveraging the concept behind the Global Maritime Partnership, because there's certain things that we can, that our allies, either due to economics or the scale of their shipbuilding programs or their ability to sustain, really can't fill, but they can bring in those gaps, kind of like in the Cold War with what we did with mine warfare and things in that area.
Well, what you get out of that actually would be more emphasis on larger ships on ocean surveillance rather than a very large program of smaller ships. You'd have some smaller ones because for some operations, it would matter a lot that we could go in whether or not we had friends. But the question would then be whether, if we have these modular things that we plan to put on the LCS, whether they could perhaps be employed by some other kind of ship.
Gellerin.
Pardon?
Well, Norm, I love the way that you put that together. The question is, where are we seeing this partnership develop, in your opinion? I mean, is Japan in on this? Is South Korea bought in? Is Australia bought in?
Those countries have been allied for a long time. And they're also spending serious money on their navies.
Right.
That's the issue. The actual issue is going to be a partnership with countries that are not allies in Africa and South America. And what we've tried to do in Africa anyway is to spread the idea that surveillance off their coast is in their own interest, and obviously we can provide some of the technology and the expertise to make that work. My guess is that's more valuable than showing up with naval forces, which they may regard as pressure. The Coast Guard is probably a more effective means than the Navy of showing up in a friendly but persuasive manner. And the Coast Guard building program is kind of important on a national level.
Yeah, that was my question. Is this what Deepwater should be leveraged in at the top end of Deepwater?
Deepwater isn't designed for any of this stuff. Deepwater is designed for a combination of ocean surveillance and executing drug interdiction and interdiction of people trying to get to the United States with explosives. But Coast Guards in general seem to be less aggressive to other governments than navies. So if you show up in a big Coast Guard cutter, you're regarded as a friend giving useful advice. If you show up in a battle group, you may be giving even better advice, but there'll be a larger segment of the local population and government that may be very nervous. We need the strike capability because nobody else can provide it. If you look around, there aren't a lot of aircraft carriers in the world that are any good. And I think that if strike becomes more and more important, the carrier capability matters more. If you marry the carrier capability with unmanned vehicles, it gets even more interesting. In fact, the price of strikes goes way down, but your ability to conduct sustained operations goes up. Also, if a lot of the current war involves headhunting, in effect, then these things seem to be a very good way of doing it. And they ought to come off the sea because eventually people will kick us out of land bases. That's a very common theme in naval warfare.
Dr. Freeman, let me. It sounds to me like you are kind of in parallel with Captain Hughes in his, I think it's the new Navy concept of a lot of smaller.
No, I'm not. Not at all.
And I'm prepared to be corrected.
Oh no. Captain Hughes likes smaller ships, and I don't. They can't be deployed easily anywhere. They can't be sustained abroad. And they duplicate local capabilities. What's so terrific about them?
So what do you think about the midway approach the Navy is taking, where they don't take a strike package so much, they use the amphibious ships, and then they engage in their more of a soft power training activities as opposed to the hard power or even the Coast Guard approach?
The way that the soft power is really the Coast Guard approach. It's saying we can provide you with expertise that you really can use. We'll show up. We'll help train you. The big amphibs are well adapted to that because they have lots of space on board. And it's not a midway approach in the sense that from the building point of view, you wouldn't get rid of the big end. The high end, to me, is very valuable. It's what we uniquely provide, or it's rather one of several things we uniquely provide. The other unique thing is we do global ocean surveillance. Nobody else does. The only way you can operate sea control with limited numbers of ships is backed up by ocean surveillance. Other people do it on a limited scale, but nothing like what we do, and the technology and expertise we have is probably extremely valuable. It's something we can trade for their assistance, in effect. Duplicating those smaller ship navies is just wasting time.
A question here, when you mentioned earlier about the, by the way, this is Sal again, the question I had for you is, you mentioned earlier about some of the possibilities of partnering with our South American friends, with Unitas. We've been doing this forever.
Sure.
But when you look south of the Panama Canal, two nations immediately come to mind. When you look at a nation that has gotten its footing, and we saw the work they did in peacekeeping and continue to do peacekeeping in Haiti, talking about Brazil. They have a potential, everybody's talked about since World War II, the great potential of Brazil.
Right.
I think they might actually be getting some grip to go forward. But when you look at on the other side of the continent, I see Chile, who really has a strong economy. They're not as big as Brazil. Are there other nations besides Brazil and Chile that you would look at partners you'd really want to build? And what do you see that those two nations bring to the table?
Okay, first of all, you have two kinds of partners. You want to get friendlier with weak countries that need strengthening. If this current war is a war of subversion, which is the way it has always looked, then the people we're up against use weak countries to get a foothold. So it's very nice that Brazil and Chile are strong, powerful, healthy countries. What we worry about aren't them. They'll do fine. They're doing fine. They figured out what to do. You worry about places that aren't doing fine. You worry about what's happening between Colombia and Venezuela over the FARC guerrillas, for example. And the people that need backing are those who are more impoverished. Now, it may be that countries like Brazil and Chile will recognize that it's in their interest to achieve greater stability throughout the hemisphere, and they will help the countries that are having problems. You can't tell. But that's probably where we have to make the effort. And we have to do it without putting people's backs up, which is very difficult.
And you look, interesting you mentioned Colombia. It's one of my favorite nations down there, and it's not just their food. But I think that's one of the great undertold stories of the last decade or so, is the very successful partnering we have done, really all the services have, down in Colombia, especially when you look at their riverine forces. They've reached
points
that we actually can learn some things from Colombia about how to do riverine operations. You see, not so much as with the big guys, they're doing fine, but to focus on those that want to go in the right direction, whether politically and economically, but to help them on the sides to get strong and to reach that same level of strength that some of their larger neighbors have.
Oh, absolutely. That's the point. Look, the basis of the maritime strategy, and a lot of American policy really goes the same way, is the idea that if the world is more prosperous in general, a lot of the more horrible things that happen go away. People get nasty because they're broke. Actually, they get nasty for a lot of other reasons, but Americans tend to focus on that. And the idea is that those whose interest it is to make the world more stable or to become more dictatorial prefer a world which is in more economic trouble. And we would like to do our best in the Navy to maintain maritime trade, which has had a lot to do with making the world more prosperous. Now, you can make all sorts of arguments about other things like the economic side of things. When people talk about soft power, they're really two different kinds of lines that they're taking. One line is sort of, let's all be happy together. And that rightly makes a lot of people upset. Another line is that national power extends to financial things as well as to military. Very often the financial may actually be more powerful. And it's almost a call for the U.S. government to spend rather more effort on its strategy for how to support and mold the world economy. Now, the last couple of years haven't been too happy here that way, but in general, as the wealthiest country in the world, we have a good deal of power. And the question is how to use it or whether it can be used effectively. You want to reward those who are making things better where they are.
I've been on the road for the better part of 3 weeks, and I'm going through books, and I'm currently reading the History of British Destroyers that you wrote. I love this book. I bought it when I was out in San Diego when we met, and I had you sign it. It's fantastic. The question I have is, I'm looking at the Littoral Combat Ship. I'm looking at the FREM project that they're doing in Europe. And people are talking about the LCS being the next evolution of destroyers. The frigate of the 21st century is a phrase that we've seen Lockheed Martin executives use in proceedings. I just want to get your take on whether you see this as the evolution that people are saying that it will be, and is Bob Work right when he makes the claim, which is kind of a bold claim, that the whole world will be envious of us when we get this stuff to work?
Oh, dear. Well, you probably know that in print I haven't been exactly a fan.
Yeah, I'm aware.
The first thing about it is that I think the modular idea is really good. I think that the obsession with very high speed is really bananas. High speed, very high speed, usually turns out very unpleasantly for everybody. The French were real good at it between the wars. Afterwards, the French officers said he wished they'd never thought about it. High speed makes for drinking fuel like you're going nuts, which is not too smart in a world where fuel gets more expensive. It tends to mean that your machinery is more delicate because you had to shave away the weight to keep up the speed. If you look at the LCS with the semi-planing hull, I think it needs about 100,000 horsepower, which is kind of weird. And my understanding is that the speed was never really justified in any logical way. It was just sexy. It's not clear why you would want a small, tightly designed surface ship for that purpose. Because of the modules, the thing is essentially an aircraft carrier. Not carrying aircraft, but carrying these unmanned vehicles which screw these sensors. It's a very good idea. It's a very nice idea. All right, here's a question. Aircraft carriers pay off because you can mix and match the airplanes on board. They managed to make this thing fairly small, and it's not that small, by concentrating on only a single kind of module per ship. The only reason for that was they wanted an El Cheapo ship, and it's not so El Cheapo. So why is it such a hot idea? The reason that it's kind of mixed up is that it was done very, very fast because money for larger numbers of surface combatants was suddenly available after 9/11. And the Navy made a terrific case for having a lot more surface combatants so it could spread around its worldwide power. It was a very good case, by the way. I really liked it. The trouble is that that wasn't the case for these particular characteristics. It was a case for something that you could build in fairly large numbers. And the thing was essentially thrown together. People have kind of not noticed that. The world will indeed envy 45-knot ships for a while. They're very sexy. But we're supposed to be adults who think beyond that. And I don't think it's the next evolution of anything. I think it's about as hot as the PHM was. PHM is not even remembered anymore. It was a lovely hydrofoil with terrific technology. It did exactly what it was supposed to do. It was advertised as a terrific modular ship that would replace all big, fat, ugly, stupid surface combatants, and it's dead. It's so dead that we couldn't even unload it on anybody else. And I think this is the same story.
Given that strong feeling you have, Dr. Freeman, what should we be looking for a littoral warship?
There isn't any such role. Period. If you want to operate in littoral, buy yourself a lot of these modules. Buy yourself something big enough to carry a fair number of them and sustain itself. By the way, these things are not self-sustaining in any sense. They're 21-day endurance. You notice that we haven't quite bought a lot of depot ships to support them in forward areas. And spend the money on the modules. That's the thing that's new. Act as though there's this fight for the littorals, whatever that's supposed to mean, in which dozens of enemy swarm boats come out and have to be fought back. Well, first of all, if you want to knock off swarming boats, if they were a serious threat, use helicopters with machine guns. They're real good at it. If you want to wipe out other people's missile attack boats, which, by the way, don't exist in such humongous numbers, again, your own missiles fired from the air probably do the trick. Now, the other problem is mines, lots of them, and the modules and the unmanned vehicles look like they're a real good way of changing mine countermeasures. So what exactly is it that we're doing that involves this fight for littorals that you have to have a lot of small, hot-looking surface combatants for? I don't quite get it. But I just don't understand the beauty and newness of these sexy surface combatants.
I'll tell you what, Dr. Freeman, I have not been a fan of LCS since it first came out. I've been pinging on it for the blog. And you, since day one, back in 2004.
Well, clearly, I haven't convinced you to change your mind.
No, I'm still not a fan of LCS at all. And the one thing that was always brought up about it, people would defend it about, was something you mentioned: the modules. But where we find ourselves in 2010 is the fact they're not even buying that many mission modules to begin with, and we've reached a point that they're not buying the mission modules, which had the one way that maybe LCS would prove me wrong. And what they're doing instead is you're also seeing people talking about how it's the replacement frigate. And I'm sure you've seen the AA module.
But it doesn't do those jobs.
It doesn't at all.
You can modify it. There's talk about, you can put on a towed sonar. Yes, you certainly can. But you don't need 45 knots to make that worth the trouble. In fact, it's crazy to. You can use it for maritime interdiction, which may turn out to be an unbelievably important job, but you don't need very high speed. And if you have a fairly large ship with helicopters on board, it's probably a better bet. For anti-piracy, yes, if you could go 45 knots, you could almost go as fast as a cigarette boat. On the other hand, your helicopter can go a whole lot faster. Unless you sort of act as though the air no longer supports helicopters, having a ship which is very fast seems to be kind of stupid. The other thing is that it doesn't make it survivable because it can't outrun either a torpedo or a missile. So you have something which is fairly flimsy because you got to save weight to make speed, and it's operating in the most dangerous area, which is filled with torpedoes and mines and anti-ship missiles and everything else that bad people produce. It has very limited self-defense. RAM and that 57-millimeter gun are not an enormous thing. So why is this a terrific bargain?
Not to mention the fact that you're never going to use 45 knots when you're doing mine warfare. Galvin, did you have another question for Dr. Friedman?
Yeah, the Littoral Combat Ship was one of three elements that came from the C portion of Sea Power 21. It was the DDG 1000 and then the cruiser. And both the DDG 1000 has been truncated. The cruiser's gone. Is this the I guess we should call it the tragedy of the 21st century Navy, Sea Power 21, in hindsight? How do we look at Sea Power 21 now?
Sea Power 21, to me, was a discussion of basic principles. Most naval strategy documents try to explain to people who don't understand what navies can do what navies are about. That's a very valuable function, and because it seems so obvious, if you're involved with navies, people forget it. That's what matters. As far as the ships went, the reason that the DDG 1000 was a disaster was that the Navy got turned on by stealth, and the people who bought the destroyer didn't realize how impractical the level of stealth required really was. That has to do with a badly broken procurement system, which isn't even the Navy's fault. It comes out of a demand by the Office of Secretary of Defense in the 1990s that the Navy discard what until then had been a very effective procurement system. That's a tragedy, and it doesn't have to do with the Navy, except that the Navy was a victim. DDG 1000 is a mess because it's so large for what you get, and it's so large because, it'll sound funny, because it's stealthy. Because basically you have to cover everything with the right shape. And even with that degree of stealth, it probably won't work terribly well. But it'll be a terrific way of going bankrupt. As far as the cruiser goes, that's probably going to come back. The reason it's going to come back is that one of the things that we can very usefully offer other countries is to provide them with anti-missile defense without being on their soil. And I'll bet you that'll be a terrific demand. So something big with a very high-powered radar and a lot of anti-missile missiles will probably come back at some point. And, of course, if you take the Chinese carrier attack missile seriously, it's kind of useful for protecting the carrier. I hope it doesn't look like DDG 1000 because that's an abortion. But the tragedy was that the Navy sort of lost sight of what it really needed in favor of what looked sexy. And I'm not quite sure of how that happened, but you can only hope that it'll go away in favor of the more boring but rather good things we've had. I mean,
speaking of boring things we might need to have, what's your view on the sea base concept?
Well, again, if you start out with sea basing, all it says is that if we can dominate the area offshore, then we can use it effectively. And if you can avoid having a beachhead, which is what the Marines want very much to avoid, then it's much, much harder for someone to figure out where you're going to come ashore, and you can do a much better amphibious operation. Since no one has a lot of firepower anymore, it's very hard to go across a defended beach. The whole thing in amphibious operations is to avoid the defenses. You try to avoid defenses by making it hard for someone to guess where you'll come ashore. If you have to have a beachhead, you have to have a beach big enough to contain the stuff that you use to assemble for push inland. So a sea base gets attractive for that. Sea base also gets attractive if countries will accept our presence, but not with a whole lot of Americans ashore. For example, when we went into Afghanistan in 2001, we badly needed to be able to fly aircraft all the way up to that Marine base near Kandahar, which turned out to be kind of important. Pakistanis would allow us to fly over Pakistan, but a lot of Pakistani citizens were very, very unhappy with what we were doing. So the Pakistan government did not want a large American base built up inside Pakistan. This was really important. Well, we had the amphibs offshore. It turned out that the amphibs could land what was needed rather easily in small quantities, and then it became fairly easy to move it up to Kandahar. That made a tremendous difference. That was a sea base. No one called it that, but that's what it was. Now, if you set up a real sea base, there are all kinds of technical problems, but the real question about a sea base is how you defend it. And if the thing actually hangs around in one place, it becomes vulnerable to all sorts of attacks like ballistic missiles that people now have. Now, that also would be a reason for buying ships with serious anti-ballistic missile capability. How well that actually works out it's a question of how well we can defend some area or shore, or whether we can keep moving it around. And there are other technical issues. Talking about a specific program called the sea base may not be all that bright. Talking about using the sea and ships offshore as a dominant capability is a terrific idea. It's what the Navy's about. You see the difference?
Dr. Friedman, we're about 2 minutes left in the show, and just to wind things up here, your latest book is The British Destroyers from Earliest Days to the
right.
Second World War. And as you're going through the research to develop that book and you're putting it together, was there something that you saw with how the British developed their destroyers up through 1939 that maybe clicked in your head and said, that's a lesson that we need to remember that we could take and think about as we look forward in the Navy that we need to focus with on our ships?
Actually, when you look at British development, the lesson is kind of that they messed up. I'm doing British cruises now, which are even more like this. The British got very good at designing ships very tightly, and they're elegant designs. Unfortunately for them, the world does not stay in one place. It keeps changing. When they hit World War II, a lot of new technologies suddenly became necessary, like radar, and they already had sonar, but a lot more depth charges and things like that. Oh, dear. All of a sudden, all those nice, elegant designs were too small. And in cruises, it's even more obvious. They kill themselves all through the interwar period to try to restrict the size of ships by treaty so they could afford enough. And that's the same kind of numbers versus size problem we have now, right? Well, they did a really good job. And then they found out that the ships they designed were a little too cleverly designed. They were too tight. And in particular, for one of these designs, if you look at their records, ever after, once the thing is being built, it's all, oh, my dear, what are we going to do, what are we going to do? Because every time they try to add the most trivial things, they're in trouble. The answer is, smaller is not a real good idea. Being smart about how to be tight is dumb.
One of the regular commenters on all of our blogs is a ship fitter, goes by Byron most of the time. And that's one of the things that he pings on a lot. Is when you get smaller, you got less to work with. And less to work with, unfortunately, we are only done seconds. Dr. Friedman, first of all, I want to thank you very much for coming on to Midrats and taking time this Sunday afternoon to do it. And I would really hope to have you back in the future, because speaking for Dalrin and Eagle One, sir, I think we could go on for hours on end. So thank you very much for your valuable time.
Thank you for having me.
Come up on chat and ask the question there. Eagle One keeps an eagle eye on chat for any questions that may come up. We're going to pivot now for the subject of today's episode, which is of the Suede Boot Navy. And our first guest, as promised, many of us know him from his various places that he lurks on the Internet. Our battle yeoman, our yeoman in the stand, we've known him since he was YNSN, and he is now YN2 to his coworkers, and that's how we'll refer to him right now. YN2, he has been in the Navy all of 3 years, but they've all been sea duty. He is a sailor's sailor, and if you ever have a chance to sit down and talk with him, some people are worried about the future. I'm not worried about the future, because he's kind of the type of sailor that I know, and when I left the Navy, that I felt comfortable with. Like I always say, it's not the youth that's the problem, it's the old people that are the problem. But he's ESWS qualified, and he is now on a one-year stint in Bagram Air Base in Afghanistan, north of Kabul. This is his second deployment for 1 year. YN2, welcome to Midrats.
Thank you, sir, and you're far too gracious with your introduction.
No problem at all. And I wonder if you could take for a second and just tell us, you've been in 3 years. You got done with your first tour. So tell the listeners where you did your first tour, when you left it, and what would you come away from your first shipboard with the best part of the Navy that you saw working on your first shipboard tour?
Well, technically, I'm still on my first tour. left my parent command there. I'm just IA right now. When I return back CONUS, I'll be PCSing from there. So kind of turn this into more of a GSA billet, even though it's IA. Best things I took away from it is really just camaraderie. I mean, depending on who you work with, that makes or breaks your command. And I come from the Amphib Navy, off of one of the newer Amphibs at that. And through the trials and tribulations thereof, it's really just the people that get you through it. It's the people you talk to up on the smoke deck. It's the people you talk to down in the berthing. And despite what the mistakes that the Navy might make throw at you, you know, you get through it because of those who are standing right there next to you. And he kind of singled me out as saying, you know, it's the youth that you don't really have to worry about. It's all of them. I mean, the biggest thing is just seeing those guys that are really, you love working with them, you love being with them, but for one reason or another, they choose to get out, you know.
That's always the heartbreak I found is you have a really strong, especially a young mid-grade NCO like yourself, who's really strong, really pushing forward, and they want to get out, and you're torn between two things going, man, the Navy needs you, but they come at you and they go, I've got this opportunity, that opportunity, and that opportunity, and you go, well, it's hard to say no to you. Eagle One, do you have a question you wanted to throw at our guest?
Not at the present time. Go ahead.
Well, here's a softball for you. Tell us how you you came back from your first, no kidding, amphib deployment, and now you have found yourself on a one-year IA. How did you get here?
I got here back in August. The request came down from higher up to say that they needed a Y&2 to go out there. It was me. There's really just two of us on board the ship that would qualify. The other Y&2 was senior to me. She was filling in as the ship's sec billet. I went ahead and volunteered for it. Really wasn't looking forward to my third workup cycle. We didn't get through the first one. We got through the second one, finally deployed, gearing up for the third one. Was not looking forward to that. Decided, hey, it was either now or my 5 years of shore duty coming up. Jumped at it. Then, you know, I could see it on the horizon what was going to happen out here in Afghanistan, and I wanted to be here and see it happen for the learning process, if nothing else. And volunteered. 2 weeks later, found out I was going to do it. Another 2 weeks after that, found myself over in the Navy's Infinite Wisdom in San Diego for my processing at NMPS. Went through that, flew from there back to South Carolina, Camp McGrady. 2 weeks, it's supposed to be a 3-week process, but for whatever reason, our training cycle was compressed down to 2. I don't know if that had to do with the upcoming holidays or whatnot, but they got us up and through it. And then on Thanksgiving Day, found myself in Kuwait, spent a week there. And 3 December, found myself here at Bagram Airfield at ODAR 30 trying to figure out where my bee hut was. That's the long and the short of it.
How's winter treating you so far?
Beautiful. I don't think you can really consider this a winter in Afghanistan. From my understanding, it's supposed to be hovering around -5 degrees Celsius every single day. But I'm seeing temperatures in the mid-60s every day. Making jokes with my buddies back in Norfolk that our weather's better out here than it is for them back there. So I've got nothing to complain about weather-wise thus far.
It'll change for you. Maybe you'll be lucky like I am and experience a couple of real strong earthquakes that wake you up at 3 o'clock in the morning.
Right.
Did the Army run your train, or are you in a joint training facility to get you ready to go on an IA?
NMPS is all reservists, at least the one out in San Diego that I worked with. That was my first experience actually seeing a unit of reservists in action, and I can't say enough good about them. They were nothing but professional. They handled it. They made it look easy. You know, you have a bunch of active duty sailors going through there. Half of them don't want to be there. Half of them do. All want to go in different directions, herding cats. They handled it like pros. Got us through there. All the wickets hit. Excellent. Once we got to McGrady, it's all Army. Again, reservists. They blew my mind. Had a slightly jaded opinion of the Army prior to McGrady. But once we got there and met the first sergeant, they started giving us rifle training, everything like that. Nothing but top-notch. Stellar performance. I would gladly serve in the Army if all the Army were like them. However, now that I'm out here in Afghanistan, I kind of see a little bit more of the real Army and realize just how stellar our trainers were back there in McGrady.
Excellent. How are you enjoying your Army uniform?
It's the best uniform I've worn, with the exception of our dress uniforms. to bring it to the NWU, it's the uniform the NWU should have been. We should have just done a copy and paste job, changed the color or whatever, and put this uniform on. A lot of people weren't fond of the Velcro. I haven't had any problems with it, but it does. Once you wash it a good couple of times, the Velcro tends to fail. Well, the Velcro fails, okay, but the uniform's comfortable and you can wear it both in hot and cold weather. I think it's good to go. Like I said, it's the best uniform I've worn thus far in a working environment.
Without showing too much leg, I wonder if you could help educate some of our more seasoned listeners, so to speak. Back in the old Cold War days, really up till 9/11, the Navy had an innate fear of giving its sailors any type of weapon, any way, shape, or form, unless you had a few people. If you were on a ship that had some nuclear depth charges and stuff, they obviously had a few people that would do that as well. But you saw a shift after 2001 to do that more. Now, you were you had some experience with weapons on board ship, but why don't you tell us right now the how you deal every day with weapons in your position as it stands right now.
Well, once you're IA and you get your you have your weapon issued to you in Grady, it's 24/7. You do not leave your weapon anywhere. You sleep next to it. You carry it with you everywhere you go. I mean, I don't mean just a condition 4 weapon. I mean you're locked and loaded, with the exception of the round in the chamber a lot of times. The mindset in the Navy tends to be that they're afraid of us having this weapon, period. I mean, you're given your weapon for your watch. They take it back from you after the watch. And I wish I could say more, but for OPSEC reasons, I can't. But, I mean, it's night and day in not a good manner the way the Navy trains with its weapons, the way they train their sailors to treat their weapons, and the way they expect us to go ahead and operate them when they are given to us. A lot of work needs to be done. There's a ton of lessons learned from the Army. The way I understand it, I mean, there's a lot of learning that needs to happen, a lot. They need to focus. They need to just look at the Army doctrine and copy and paste. It'll work for us. You just treat it that way. I mean, at boot camp, here's the best example. When I was at boot camp, we got some training on the M500 Mossberg. It was all classroom, basically death by PowerPoint. Then all of a sudden, voila, you've got a Mossberg in your hands, and you're told to fire at a target. Well, truth be told, I never even touched a weapon prior to the Navy. I'm standing there with my Mossberg. I've got my earplugs in. I can't hear it very well. I've got the goggles on. Of course, they're yelling at you. It's boot camp. And I shot the post holding the target right there, and it just broke the target. It just fell right down on the ground. The instructor looked at me, grabbed the Mossberg out of my hand, told me to get the hell out of there. That was my experience with the Mossberg.
That's how you became a yeoman?
Right there. Yeah, basically, yes. I saw my proficiency right there, and they just said, the desk for you and a pen, nothing more.
Yeah, I think that was the one thing that when I found myself in your neighborhood my last year on active duty, is I kind of was like, okay, so I carry a weapon everywhere, every day. Yes, sir, you do. Do I get a Barney bullet? Oh, no, here's three clips. There you go.
Yeah.
You put one clip in the gun when you leave. It was really an eye-opener for me. But after a while, you get used to it. Everybody has a weapon, and yeah, I remember that in some places in the Navy and CONUS, and I'm sure you can appreciate it, if you walked over to somebody and said, by the way, all your yeomen are going to be armed at work today, half of the officers aren't going to show up.
Right. Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. I don't even think the gunner takes would show up to even issue you the weapon.
There aren't enough arrows in CONUS.
No, there really aren't. And the thing I don't get about it is how they can consider us proficient when we only have to qualify twice a year. I mean, the Army is constantly qualifying. It's part of their promotion system to go ahead and allow their men to advance if you're proficient in your weapon. I mean, the Navy, we have all these force protection requirements now, but we're not treating it. We're only doing like half the equation. We're saying that, hey, this is really important. This is mandatory. We're going to make you lose sleep over it, but we're not going to go ahead and tie that into your training continuum at all, just a little 2 days out of the year off of work early, to go down to the range with the GM. That's about it.
Yeah, my experience in one of the prior deployments with my Inshore Undersea Warfare unit was that our CBs were well qualified. They had similar qualification requirements as a lot of the other as a lot of the Army guys, but the run-of-the-mill sailor, the yeoman and my sonar men and my OSs weren't too familiar with weapons, personal weapons.
No. And I mean, I see this multitude of lessons learned from just my couple of months out here thus far. And the only thing I can keep wondering is if JFCOM is actually tracking all this. It's my understanding that Joint Forces Command, it's their job to go in and look at how all the lessons learned from all the various branches are going to tie together. I saw one officer in my training that actually had a JFCOM badge on his left arm saying that he deployed with him before, but thus far I haven't seen anybody ask any questions. I've checked a few sailors out to send them back CONUS, and there's nobody that seems to really be asking any lessons learned, let alone important ones. They're going to ask, were you happy? Were you fed well? What could we improve to make it easier for you to get out there? Yeah, it's nice and good to go ahead and make sure that the sailor's content in going out here and doing an IA billet, but what about, honestly, the lessons learned? What did the Army teach you that can make the Navy better? Where does the Navy lack in compared to the Army? I mean, uniforms, weapons quals, watch standing, I mean, the list goes on. And I'm not intricately involved in any of the Army watch standing, but just being around it, it's blatantly obvious what we can learn from them. And I don't see anybody really tracking it. I mean, even the Army. The Army doesn't even, you know, I'm talking to them just managing an office. The Army has a ton to learn from us on how to manage an office, how to organize files. Just the same, we have a lot to learn from how that they go ahead and do their administration online. The Army can go ahead and do 90% of all of their needs for their soldiers, one, deployed, and two, online. When I deployed on my ship last year, we weren't able to go ahead and fix a sailor's pay unless we went ahead and waited for Papa Det back in Norfolk to go ahead and come back to work from the weekend, get in at work at 9 a.m., and then spend 2 or 3 days processing it. Out here, NASA can do it in an hour. Out here, the Army can do it. Any one of their soldiers can do it. It's not a special qualified individual. You know, tons of lessons learned, and I don't see anybody tracking it.
Yeah, I have a post and draft that I'll probably sit out here in a week or so. It's basically the premise of it. There's more to joint than JPME 1 and 2. And there are things that we can learn from our other services. And I know on Admiral Harvey's blog, you left a good comment that he was very welcome to about PEO soldier and PEO sailor. And I also know your personality type. You're not one to sit on your hand. So I just ask, keep them up in your head. You're going to be given the opportunity here, both during the rest of your IA and when you come back, to help share these lessons. And first of all, though, I just wanted to thank you for volunteering to go on the IAYN2. It's absolutely much better to have somebody next to you who wants to be there than somebody that had to be there. And we ask that you keep in touch, and most of all, that you keep safe, and we'll be in talk with you soon. Thank you very much for calling up YN2. Do you have anything at the last minute?
No, I think we pretty much summed it up well there, sir.
Beautiful, YN2, and have a very good deployment. We'll be talking to you soon. And our next guest today, we'll just go ahead and roll into him. Our next guest is Commander Charles Malone. He is, I don't know what the deal is with P3 people. We had one last weekend. We got another one this weekend. by training and warfare specialty, Commander Malone is a P3 pilot with experience in the late, great Brunswick Naval Air Station with BP-11. He's also been a shooter on the Kitty Hawk, so he has actually earned an honest day's pay. And he has been through the usual staff colleges, M3 and M5 background over at Compact Fleet, where he's been working on his surf style and his tan. He's had enough of the tropical life, though, and he'll be leaving in July for the NATO Defense College in Rome. And why we brought him on board here is he also had a very unique opportunity. He's the former commanding officer of Navy Provisional Detainee Battalion 5 in Camp Buka, Iraq. Commander Malone, welcome aboard MIDREPS.
Thanks, Viv. It's great to be a part of your show.
And when I think what's interesting is when you throw out there Navy Provisional Detainee Battalion 5, well, first of all, I didn't know there was one, much less five. What do they do, and why were they in Camp Buka? Give us a quick summary of your command and your sailors and what your responsibility was there.
I know it's pretty much the worst name for a command ever, and it never comes without an explanation. So, well, first of all, we it's a provisional detainee, battalion, which meant that it was stood up for just a short period of time. So where one we go there, our command authority comes from CENTCOM. So we are established in theater, and then we're disestablished. Basically, as we fade away into the night. So we go and we relieve a battalion that preceded us. So there's no change of command ceremony or anything like that. But we start the training in an MPS like most for a week, and then we did, in our case, we went to Fort Dix in New Jersey for 2 months. In three different cycles, an Alpha and a Bravo and a Charlie company. And so we would train 2 weeks apart, Alpha, then Bravo, then Charlie 2 weeks later. And then we would deploy in those phases to replace in phase NPDB-4 before us. So we're there for the purpose of provide care, custody, and control to the detainees at Camp Buka. And like other places and commands and ships I've been, Camp Buka is no longer with us. Fortunately, that mission is smaller than it used to be. Camp Buka had, when I arrived, over 20,000 detainees. And when I left, we were much less than half that number. But the Navy had a very interesting job. We cared for detainees in modular detainee housing units. We had five different compounds, and they were the most extreme of the extreme. So the worst of the worst were controlled by, I would say, the best of the best. Even combat yeomen like our YN2 were holding a non-lethal weapon or an M16 and guarding detainees. So it was a fascinating situation because you have to build the battalion up from scratch. So the administrative things you think about as a CO, you have to kind of put in place. And it's also another unique command in that the command is still attached by all these strings to parent commands back at home. So we still do the career counseling. In fact, most people come in a 9-month window of orders. A lot of them did, in fact. So we have a career counselor who's working on caffeine and cigarettes, and then you have a yeoman staff who's trying to help out the pay and admin needs, and doing so in a very interesting fashion. It takes about four times as much admin to run a command like that. And you also think about the everybody gets an eval, everybody gets an award. So you do that all in 1 year. And so it's a very interesting command in a lot of respects.
Like, I can imagine both you and your XO and your support staff, that must have been a lot of overhead there for you, because you are such a provisional unit we put together, and you know all your sailors, the number one concern is what's next. Did a lot of them show up to you saying, okay, you're going to go and do this, and when you're done, here's your next set of orders? Or were most of your sailors in limbo with their detailers in the middle of their tour there?
I would say you had everything. I mean, we had 80% maybe 70% were individual augmentees, some GSAs, and then probably 15% reservists. That was my provisional detainee battalion. Other commands were different, had a different makeup. Some of them were more IA, some of them are heavier on the reservists. I was the fifth one at Buka, and there were some in Afghanistan and up north in Baghdad. But to answer your question, in my case, I would say that a large percentage, more than half, were in their 9-month windows for orders while we were there. So, and if they were not coordinating their orders for their next follow-on command, they were talking to their reserve command about their next duty, or because some of them would would deploy again at the end of that. So the amount of contact with the detailers and the parent commands and coordinating those orders was immense. So I would say that we had that the sailors had I'm not sure if I answered your question very well, but significant efforts with regards to the detailers, and they all had the same concerns as any other command. So,
who was your senior NCO that you had there at your right hand, and did he have a background in correctional custody or Briggs, or was this kind of terra incognita to him when he first started?
Well, I will tell you that I really hit a gold mine with my command master chief. It was Master Chief Scott Fleming. He was a journalist in the Navy and then became a command master chief. But he's currently the task force master chief down in Gitmo right now. So that detainee experience, which was his first detainee experience with us, but it kind of led to a follow-on with him. So he's working with he went from me, he moved up to a one-star staff to go do that in Gitmo. And that's where he is right now. He did a fantastic job and really worked to ensure that we maintained a sailor identity in an Army world.
Eagle One, did you have a question you wanted to throw at Commander Malone?
In the detainee group, was that reserve heavy? How did you get your assets for that?
I'm not sure I understand the question. How did we fit our assets?
I guess I'm asking where your personnel came from. Were some of them reserves?
As we had about 15% reserves. And then the rest were IAs and GSAs. So, I will tell you that, you hear about people always have comments about the sailors that you get. When I could not tell who was reserve and who was active duty, because the job was so distant from what most of them did in their other jobs in the Navy or in the civilian life, that we all worked towards a common core competency, and it just came down to individual integrity, effort, and those are the types of things that went into their quality. So they were reservists, IA, GSA. They were all the same.
Did you was your immediate superior there an Army guy?
Well, that's a very interesting question, and I think that if you asked my immediate, I had different chains of command, and if you ask each one of them who was in command, they would both say they were. That is one of the issues that's hard to work with. It's basic OPCON, ADCON, TACOM. Those types of questions are very important in command relationships. It's definitely something that we had trouble with, because what was on paper and what was practiced on a day-to-day basis, there was a difference between the two. So I had to work to help resolve some of those issues, and sometimes that brought tension. But immediately, tactically, we worked for the 42nd MP Brigade that's out of Fort Lewis, Washington. We also, OPCON was held by the Navy, so through NAVSENT. So that is how that works. So I would work with NAVSENT on occasion, especially with administrative-related issues. But when it came down to the day-to-day care, custody, and control, that was with the Army. So an Army colonel.
When it deals with arcane bureaucratic rules and turf wars, I can think of no better preparation for you when you show up in Rome for the NATO Staff College. That is their bread and butter, baby. You are set to go. Let me ask you a question here. The You mentioned that your command master chief had a journal, JO background, journalist. In detainee ops, that is such a sensitive political and diplomatic issue. Did you have CODELs visit you? And if you did, we got just about a minute remaining. How did that interaction go with you?
Well, that's an excellent question. We had a lot of CODELs. We had people from the International Red Cross, which was interesting. We had 4 stars and 3 stars visit. So I would say more on the military and the international visits than our own congressman visits. So that, in fact, I maybe a couple while one, and mostly staffers who would come. But bottom line, the interaction was very positive. We would take them in and we would show them what we did, and they were always very impressed with the professionalism of the Navy and the sailors and how they did their job. And they were always amazed at that sailors and battle yeomen and you know storekeepers could watch with detainees of that nature so well. So it was always very positive. Surprisingly.
And that folds into to much of my experience well, whether it's dealing with somebody from the Red Cross or some of these CODELs who haven't worked with the military before. I think the more opportunities we get to bring those people here and let them talk to our sailors, the better off we'll be, because they always come away going, wow, y'all aren't bloodthirsty imbeciles. Y'all are actually great people who are really concerned. It works out real well. And I'm down to 15 seconds. And I just wanted to thank you for coming on, just like with our battle yeoman. We could have made a whole hour of this. Thank you very much. Thank you much for the listeners. And thank you for those who are up on the chat.